This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Mr. Cargill!
Yes, sir?
You're aware of the name of this podcast, aren't you, Mr. Cargill?
Very aware, sir.
It bears a proud name, doesn't it, Mr. Cargill?
Very proud, sir.
It represents fine movies.
Battle Truck and Skate Town, sir.
What is that name, Mr. Cargill?
Junk Food Cinema, sir.
And what do we say?
Snack the Planet!
Stargrove! Welcome to a particularly subversive episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Protocol. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, and my XO, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Or am I your XO? I'm not really sure how the chain of command breaks down when we're in the drive-thru, because I feel like that's the only place we actually have a chain of command is who orders first.
Well, like, I literally just ordered takeout that's coming, and I said, you want anything? And you were like, no, and I ordered it anyway.
Because you knew that my mouth said no, but my stomach said yes.
I'm telling you, these fried chicken drumlets are going to fucking melt
your
brain.
I'm super excited for them.
Some people are like, this is a bit, and it's like, we're recording and have timed it perfectly to where when we are done, we will have delicious, delicious Indian takeout.
And we will be eating it on this podcast, which you can find all of our back catalog episodes on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. And if you're on iTunes, please go there and give us a rating and leave a review. We always love to read those. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean, you really like this show,
if it's the das best thing you've ever heard, you can support us at Junk Food Cinema, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And I want to remind you guys yet again that in addition to getting, for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content every week nobody else gets to hear. The $5 per episode level and above, you get access to a full extra episode called The Deep Dish on top of everything else. And if you're a patron at any level, you get to hear the ad-free version of the show before everyone else does. So benefits all around, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Guys, we are continuing our series that is so manly, so majestic, that King Kong ain't got shit on it.
It's just okay.
It's better than okay. It's the Denzel Watching-thon.
Okay.
Forgiveness is between them and God. It's my job to arrange the meeting.
Okay.
So you are what you are in this world. That's either one of two things. Either you're somebody.
I'm the man up in this piece.
Or you're nobody.
I run shit here. You just live here.
Okay.
King Kong ain't got shit on me.
And this week's movie, I will say, as much as I love Ricochet, you could argue, you could make the case that this is a slightly better movie.
Last week?
This week's movie is, in fact, Crimson Tide.
As you no doubt heard, my XO has appendicitis. Your name was at the top of the list.
Well, that's good to know, sir.
It was a short list. This year,
we have a properly formatted emergency action message from National Command Authority.
What we've always known.
Bravo, Echo, Echo, Charlie, Alpha.
Becomes what we've always feared.
Telling this to the captain, Russian rebels have threatened to launch against our country and are fueling right now. This is not a drill.
Now.
Sir, we have a possibly submerged submarine.
You find out who that is.
Receiving emergency action message. Recommend alert one.
The battle for survival begins.
That's a message fragment.
Sir, we don't know what this message means. Our target package could have changed.
I've made a decision.
There's no place for fear.
He's lost his nerve.
I'd rather go out myself and get this one wrong.
There's no room for mistakes.
If we launch and we're wrong, what's left of Russia is going to launch at us.
I'm captain of this boat. I don't have to think this over.
There's no time for doubt.
The missile system's ready to launch in 6 minutes.
You repeat this order or I'll find somebody who will.
Hell no, you won't, sir.
And nothing can stop the tide.
Give me the missile key, Mr. Hunter.
Sir, we are going down.
I'm the commander of this ship.
Crimson Tide.
It is probably amongst the very best movies we've ever covered.
I would agree with that. It's weird that, you know, normally when we talk about the core values of junk food cinema, because we've definitely disagreed sometimes on what movies to cover based on the fact that they just feel too respected and too well known and too elite for something like junk food cinema. This movie, for some reason, as good as it is, as legitimate quality as it is, it still feels just junky enough to qualify for this show. And I can't even maybe articulately put into words, which is going to make the rest of this podcast very awkward that I can't put that into words. But there's something about this movie that despite its quality, despite that it does feel elite and it does feel respected, it still also feels kind of junky.
It might be Bruckheimer's name
based on the front. It might be the fact that it is a Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer joint. And I don't use that term very often, but if there was ever two people whose films deserve to be called a joint, it's a Bruckheimer-Simpson joint.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see that lightning bolt hit in the studio card at the beginning,
it's almost like somebody having a heart attack because of doing too much cocaine.
On the toilet, like Elvis. Like, you got to respect a man who's like, I'm going to go out like fucking Elvis. I'm going to wear a racing suit to the fucking set of Days of Thunder because I am a thrill-seeking, movie-producing son of a gun. Like, you got to, you know what, 21-gun salute.
This is one of those great mainstream movies. Like, this is a movie that was made to be a big blockbuster, you know, bold right up the middle America movie. And it is so fucking good. And of course it's so fucking good because it is by one of my favorite filmmakers of all time.
And I will say this, I think, in my opinion, that this is his best movie. I think because he's made a lot of great movies and there's a lot of movies that we talk about that have a lot more junk food renown. This, though, in terms of quality, in terms of performance, in terms of editing, everything, in terms of tension building in a small space, like, this is his best movie, in my
opinion.
I think
it's his slickest, but it'd be tough to say that Crimson Tide, it's up there, but is it better than True Romance?
I honestly think it is.
Great. I get saying it's better than Man on Fire, because we fucking love Man on Fire, but not everybody connects with Man on Fire.
That's the important thing to note, though, is that when we're talking about Tony Scott in the annals of junk food cinema, and we are talking about his best movie, we are deciding which caviar is the best fucking caviar.
Yeah, because this is something I don't know if I've said it on the podcast before. I know that I mentioned it online quite a bit when I was a film critic in print, but I think that Tony Scott was the better filmmaker of the brothers. I think he is. I think that Ridley Scott has made the most epic films and has made the best films. Like, if you put all their films in a pot together and just start picking out the very best, they're going to be Ridley Scott films. Tony Scott was consistently great. There's one or two films that you really kind of shrug off with Tony Scott, particularly towards the end of his career. I think overall there's like three films that I go, I can do without those films. The rest of them are all great. And the ones that are great, I feel that other people don't like, I feel are ignored or they're wrong about. We will, over the course of this podcast, cover virtually everything Tony Scott has ever done. Whereas Ridley Scott, there's so much chaff in there. There's, you pick a period in his life and I'll name five films that were misfires. Whereas you can't do that with Tony Scott. You know, when you're talking about his early career, you're talking about fucking Top Gun. You're talking about Days of Thunder. That's how he was kind of kicking shit off. And then you get to this era where it's, He's working with fucking Tarantino twice. You know, you've got Crimson Tide, you've got True Romance. You know, you get into 2000 with Spy Game. You get into his era. He was always kind of pushing boundaries and playing around and saying, I'm kind of done with that. I want to try this. And he makes a crazy, you know, Richard Kelly movie that I absolutely love with Domino. He makes Man on Fire. He's like, fuck it. I want to make an Unstoppable Train movie. I mean, he goes nuts and has fun and works with some of the most talented writers in Hollywood over the course of his career. And then he committed suicide.
Yeah.
It's like out of the blue, like, and nobody that knows why is talking. Everyone's saying they don't know why. Just like he climbed up on a bridge and jumped.
And of course, in the late 90s, Enemy of the State.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, no, like there's so many.
And of course, a movie. Okay, let's just talk about the movies we've covered on this show. We've got Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, The Last Boy Scout. I believe we cover Spy Game?
No, we haven't covered
Spy Game. Oh, we got to fucking cover Spy Game.
We will cover Spy Game.
Come on. I feel like we have covered True Romance at some point.
We did.
So, yeah, like this is a director who is well known around these halls.
Yeah, yeah, we will cover all of his stuff eventually. This movie is infinitely rewatchable. This is one of the very first films I bought, as I've talked about before, like Nick and Nora. How I bought
your travel movies?
As my travel movies, I bought it on Amazon, put it on my iPad, and have never taken it off. That's this. The number of times, like this movie is a movie I watched so much while I was in London making Doctor Strange, because I'd have to drive back and forth from where I was staying to the studio. So I'd spend like 45 minutes in morning traffic. I'd watch 45 minutes of Crimson Tide on the way there and 45 minutes on the way home and then 45 minutes on the way back the next day. And then maybe I'd start another movie. Maybe I'd start from the beginning again. I just watched this fucking movie a lot and I adore it. It is so snappy, so fun, so tight, and just such a great fucking film. Loaded with amazing fucking cameos.
It's crazy. I mean, Denzel Washington, obviously.
Well, yeah. So let's, for those of you that haven't seen Crimson Tide, for fuck's sake, this is one of those you absolutely must watch. But it is Denzel Washington versus Gene Hackman. And if that doesn't get your fucking dick hard or your fucking...
lady parts wet.
Exactly. I don't know what will. That is just the two biggest alpha males in the world. Guys know not only for being alpha as fuck on screen, but by their co-stars for being alpha as fuck off screen. Both of these guys, I cannot imagine what it would be like being on this set. Talk about two guys who... I've worked with people who have worked with both of them and have asked, and I get the same stories. It's great to work with. Amazingly talented human beings. But don't dare try to be the biggest dick in the room because they are the biggest dick in the room.
And that's entirely the point of this movie. That's, yes. You know, and that might be the kismet of this film is that you cast two actors who apparently, as you've said, off screen are known for being the biggest dick in the room, competing to be the biggest dick in the sub.
What so works about this movie is it is two alpha males who could not be more alpha male and could not be more right about what they're doing.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely going to get into that.
Yeah, and they're two guys who know they're right, trying to prove they're right. And holy shit, does that fill 2 hours in the best fucking way possible.
I agree. And I have to say this. This seemed initially, when I was doing my research, like a very trivial piece of trivia. But based on what we're talking about, it's actually very important. Denzel Washington, at the time of this filming, had been doing a lot of boxing. So it was his idea to add that montage of his character boxing. In boxing, if you're going to be the best, you got to beat the best. It's not always about winning or losing. It's about proving. I mean, there are Rocky movies, Creed, all of that. It's not even necessarily about the victory. It's about proving you deserve to stand in that ring with the best. And I feel like that was definitely a draw for Denzel to take this movie, is to get in that ring with Gene Hackman and those two characters duke it out. And I love the way you put that, because they're both right. This movie is a very, it's a very interesting script in that it doesn't really have a villain. And I mean, it does, and it's spelled out by a line that Denzel has, but it's not a person on that sub. Now, speaking of people on that sub, we definitely need to talk about this supporting cast, starting with Viggo Mortensen.
Holy shit.
Babyface Viggo Mortensen. Weps is one of two characters in this movie, Weps and Cobb, who those aren't their actual character names.
No, no.
Their positions on the boat.
Cobb means chief of the boat.
And Weps is the weapons officer.
Yeah.
So when you read their IMDb, when you read the IMDb profile for this movie, it lists Viggo Mortensen as Weps, and the actor, I believe his name is George Zudzna, as Cobb. And you realize, oh no, those aren't actually the character names; those are their positions on the boat. And then on top of that, because it's a Tony Scott movie and he worked with him a lot, and God bless him for it. Unfortunately, also departed from this universe, James Gandolfini.
Early Gandolfini. Like, this is before everybody realized, like, that's, here's the thing about this film. You look at this cast and several members of this, you look at this cast and it's like, wow, this is an A-list movie with a great cast. And most of this cast had not hit yet.
True story.
Nobody knew, like, the only thing, us art film guys, us fucking movie nerds knew who Viggo Mortensen was because of The Reflecting Skin, because it was this weird fucked up movie.
Yeah, I don't even know what, I won't front on you. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
You know what? We'll watch that movie at some point. It's essentially, it's an indie film about a guy that came back from the military. And it's told from the point of view of his little brother, and his brother starts dating this girl and he starts getting sick. And the boy believes that the woman is a vampire and that she's siphoning the life out of him. And what's really happening is he's been on a nuclear, like either on a nuclear submarine or at a nuclear camp, and he's got radiation poisoning and he's developed cancer from that. And, but this kid is convinced that this vampire is sucking the life out of her brother. And it's a crazy fucked up movie. But, James Gandolfini had not hit yet, would show up in another Bruckheimer film shortly after this with The Rock. Still hadn't hit yet because Sopranos hadn't happened.
But you know, just by his very presence, somebody's getting whacked on this submarine. Somebody is definitely getting whacked on this submarine.
Steve Zahn.
Oh, man.
Nobody knew who he was. He doesn't even have a line in this fucking movie.
No.
He's around, but dear God, nobody knew who Steve Zahn was at this point. He hadn't done That Thing You Do, hadn't done the Linklater films that he got into, hadn't done any of that stuff to get up and hit where he would be.
Can we also mention Private Fish Tank First Class?
Oh, yes, we can.
Ryan Phillippe in his first on-screen role?
Yeah.
Who, speaking of doesn't say anything, spends this entire movie staring at a fish tank.
Yeah.
The fuck is going on with this character? Is this Aquaman Begins? Why is he so fascinated with this fish tank? Yeah. I'm a little confused.
It is, like, and this is a who's who of people that you don't have to IMDb them to know who they are. You know who all these people are. Nobody knew who the fuck these people were when this movie got made. Like, true this story. Was the, this is literally, it is exactly like, this is when Tony Scott was on fire. Cause as we talked about in our episode for Enemy of the State, he did the same fucking thing. All these people that nobody fucking knew who they were, just pull, you know, just Jack Black and Seth Green and, you know, just pulling all these people out of his ass. Like, oh yeah, these talented young actors who would then go on to become, you know, big names in their own right. And this movie's just filled with them and everybody is acting their fucking asses off.
I do want to mention that Lilo Brancato is also in this movie, who you're probably like, that name doesn't sound familiar.
No.
You would recognize him if you saw him. He's from Bronx. A Bronx Tale. He is from Renaissance Man, and he was also killed by Tony Soprano in season 2 of The Sopranos. So again, somebody's getting whacked on this fucking submarine.
And then at the end of this movie, we get one of Jason Robards' last performances.
Man, Jason Robards.
And Jason Robards brings all of the fucking pathos you would expect to smack around two guys with his dick. It was just, he's so fatherly and so terrifying at the same time. That was the great thing about Robards.
One of my dad's favorite actors. I always loved Jason Robards.
Oh, one of mine too. And so we've got, he's one of the recognizable names in this movie at this point. It's really nuts how this cast came together.
It's so nuts that we haven't even mentioned that Ricky Schroeder's in the movie too.
Ricky Schroeder, this was like part of his comeback when he was staging a comeback in the mid 90s.
Fucking insane, man.
Yeah, and it's a very small role. And then it gets even crazier when you start talking about who wrote this movie.
Oh my God. Yes.
Because this movie was in trouble. This movie had problems. It did not get its initial cast. This is one of those Casablanca situations where its initial cast turned them down. And subsequently, you cannot imagine what the movie would look like with the cast they went out to.
Do you want me to run down?
Please.
So we have two main characters in this movie. We have Captain Ramsey, who was played in the movie by Gene Hackman. And we also have Hunter, who's played by Denzel Washington.
Lieutenant Commander Hunter?
Lieutenant Commander XO Hunter.
Hunter? Commander?
Okay, fine. Yes, Ace Hunter, played by Denzel Washington. By the way, that's a remake I would watch. The role of Captain Ramsey was initially offered to Tommy Lee Jones, who passed on it.
Yeah.
Was also offered to Al Pacino, who passed on it.
Yeah.
Warren Beatty was interested, and they went through a long period trying to sign him before all parties moved on. And one of the choices for Lieutenant Commander Hunter early on was Andy Garcia. This movie was almost Tommy Lee Jones and Andy Garcia.
This movie was almost Tommy Lee Jones and Val Kilmer.
Yes. Also, well, yes, they haven't
said who they offered it to. But
come
on. They weren't going to offer him. That they have all these seasoned older actors and then Val Kilmer. Val Kilmer was being offered the Hunter role.
Not true. He was going to be offered Private Fish Tank first class. He was going to spend the whole movie staring at the fish tank, and he decided to move on and do Island of Dr. Moreau instead.
Almost Tommy Lee Jones, Val Kilmer movie. Imagine that for a second. And are any of those iterations better than what they ended up
with?
Fuck
no.
No. Fucking way.
No, sir.
So the script was in trouble as well. Like, they were having a hard time getting it. While they were making it, they were having problems. And so they had two people come in to do punch up. One was Robert Townsend, who famously was not available to actually write it. So he dictated his rewriting of a scene over the fucking phone.
Robert Town.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said Townsend. Robert Town.
Not Meteor Man. Robert Town.
Robert Town.
Robert Town, by the way, if you're not familiar with him, who wrote movies like, I don't know, Chinatown.
Yeah.
The First Mission Impossible. Shampoo.
I can't believe I said Robert Townsend. there it is. That's a totally different movie. And in one of only two or three script doctor gigs he was ever known for, Quentin Tarantino.
And not only what I love about the fact that Quentin Tarantino worked on this movie is if you've seen this movie, I don't even have to tell you what he wrote.
No, the minute you know Tarantino worked on this movie, you will pick out the three scenes that Tarantino rewrote because they are so unbelievably 1990s Tarantino that he practically signed his fucking name to it.
Cobb, full stop. They bring the submarine down, the propeller goes off, and they start talking about pop culture because that is where Tarantino's influence on this movie is.
So let's have a scene. I know. Let's have a scene where the submarine guys are talking about their favorite submarine movies. And let's bring up obscure actors from the 50s and 60s. Let's have a conversation where we discuss have characters who are arguing over who did the best, which artist drew the best Silver Surfer.
Because you know how much Navy guys love Silver Surfer, right? Is that a thing? It might be a thing. I don't know.
You know what? First of all, comic books in this era, it was comic. And this is okay. Hold on.
Sidebar.
Old Man Cargill. That old man Cargill. So back in the day, comic books were not just available in comic book stores. They sold a lot better than they did now, and they were sold on newsstands. You could walk into any convenience store and they would have a comic rack, or they would have it in the magazine section. And on every single base, Air Force, Navy, Army that you go to, they have a BX or a PX, where they would, which was essentially like kind of like a Walmart is the best comparison, where they would sell pretty much fucking everything and a little bit of everything. And every single one of those had a large comic book section, and fucking 18, 19 year old guys, you know, bored as shit on patrol, got to do something. You've got these jobs where you're sitting around for 8 hours, you know, in case something happens. You read comic books. Comic books were a big, big thing in this era in the military. So the fact that all of these guys know Silver Surfer does not stretch plausibility. Like, it is actually very, very plausible that all these guys fucking read comic books, because of course they did.
And that they would get in fights over who wrote the better
Who drew
the better Silver Surfer, Jack Kirby or Mobius. And what I love about this scene is that the two guys are fighting and Denzel is reading one of them the Riot Act, and then just casually slips it in there that he has an opinion on it too, when he's like, the scene goes like this. He's like, I see this kind of nonsense again. I'm going to write you up. You understand? Do you understand? Yes, sir. You have set an example in the face of stupidity. Everybody reads comic books knows that Kirby Silver Surfer is the only true Silver Surfer. Now, am I right or wrong? I fucking love that about him. Denzel in this movie is no nonsense, but he's also a man of the crew.
And if you listen to that dialogue, you could tell that dialogue was written for Sam Jackson. You can just tell that is Quentin Tarantino writing for Sam Jackson before he knows he's writing for Sam Jackson.
Yeah. Just drops a couple more motherfuckers and it's like, oh yeah, okay.
There it is. Yeah. It is so painfully and yet delightfully Tarantino. Like, yes. It's a cliche, and at the same time, every single one of those scenes is pretty fucking great. And he does a great job humanizing these characters with this, because that's what he was brought in to do. The big problem they had was it was too much military speak. We didn't care about the characters. And so we needed some private moments. And so Tarantino did what Tarantino does best. He related it to pop culture. And in this era, this hadn't become ubiquitous yet. Mm-hmm. So this was really different at the time. Like, mentioning
this is before people were trying to do Tarantino.
Yeah. This is mentioning a pop culture thing was different and weird. And, oh wow, they're just like me. I can relate to a character that knows the Silver Surfer.
Which is actually tremendously important to understand Denzel's character in this movie.
Sure.
And how he differs from a character like Ramsey.
Yeah.
So absolutely. That it's actually very serving of the plot, and not just, you know, what Tarantino kind of gets made fun of for, which is diverting the plot to talk about pop culture, which you and I are in no position to judge about.
Not at all.
We have a sidebar for that reason. And before we get into the plot of this movie, I want to talk about one more creator who had his hand in this movie that we haven't really talked about yet, or we've alluded to but not touched upon: Hans Zimmer.
Oh my God, this score.
Holy shit, this score.
Oh my God, this score.
He, man, you will think The Rock. When the logo comes down, when the studio card comes down, and then you immediately see a military base in the rain, and you hear this score, you will immediately think of The Rock. But don't, because this score is so good that it actually won a Grammy in 1996 for Best Instrumental Composition Written for a Motion Picture or Television. I didn't even know that was a category, but Hans Zimmer won that fucking Grammy for this score. Yeah. And it's outstanding.
It is. Yeah, it's unreal how good this is. And there's even they reference him in the movie.
His score is so good, they name a character in the movie Zimmer to pay tribute to him.
There it is.
That is fucking baller. Like, I mean, I love Star Wars, but you don't see someone on the Death Star named, like, Ensign Williams. Like, it just, that doesn't fucking happen.
I gotta mention, for a hot minute, there was a period of time when the score for Doctor Strange was gonna be done by Hans Zimmer.
Really?
And I lost my shit. And then he decided he didn't want to do superhero movies anymore, that he was done with superheroes.
Oh, that's a shame.
And so, yeah, then we ended up with, you know, the no-name guy that we ended up with. You know how that goes.
Yeah. Was it Giacchino? Fuck you. God, fuck you. Ugh. I remember in a little dash of unfiltered wife, I remember the other night trying to explain to Lauren who Giacchino was. She's like, I have no idea who that is. I'm like, yes, you do. He scored this, this, and this. And she's like, I don't know. And I was finally like, I don't, Star Trek? And she's like, oh, the one with Chris Pine. I'm like, yes.
Star Trek, Lost.
She's like, I love that movie.
Pixar movies. Yeah.
And I'm like,
He's our generation's John Williams. Like, he's fucking amazing.
Exactly. And I'm like, oh, well, you love that movie. So you remember the music. And she's like, no, I remember Chris Pine. I was like, God damn it.
I was over the moon. Like, it's like, okay, I don't get to work with Zimmer, but. Okay. So yeah, but Zimmer is this. I mean, this soundtrack is a masterpiece. It was really building on Hunt for Red October without copying it, and I think that both of those scores listened to together, kind of like just really nails the whole military submarine Navy thing. Like, it just really gets it. And
well, he blends it with actual Navy hymns and then a little bit of kind of Russian choruses, because the plot of this movie is that a breakaway Russian dictator has seized control of some military silos in Russia that house their ballistic missiles and is threatening basically the world, but especially the United States, with nuclear war. And so a submarine that is on its is dispatched. It is the submarine that carries the nuclear warheads, is dispatched to basically be the last line of defense in case shit's going to go down. Shit's going to go down from both sides. And that submarine is captained by Gene Hackman, who is, he's a very seasoned submarine captain. And you want to talk about no nonsense. He's the kind of guy that will tell you to get the fuck off his boat when they're 500 feet underwater. He does not give a shit about your shit. And he reluctantly has to hire on a new commanding, XO. What does XO stand for?
Executive officer.
Executive officer. Thank
executive
you.
Executive officer is kind of a second in command. It's, and I say kind of, because the executive officer is the person who can override the captain. It's to prevent mutinies, essentially. It's the person who's there to serve under the captain, but can remove the captain from his command if he is deemed unfit.
Right. And which is entirely important, and that redundancy and that chain of command is a huge part of what this movie is about. Because what ends up happening is during the course of their duty, they get these emergency action messages that they could say a lot of different things. They could get them in succession. And this is coupled with the drills that they run. And so they get one of these messages that says, basically, this dictator is fueling up the missiles, you know, get ready to launch. And then during the course of they start to receive another transmission, they are intercepted by a Russian sub and they're doing battle with that sub, and they sink to a depth and they lose their communication and they don't get the rest of the second message. And so all Gene Hackman knows is that the first message said, launch the nukes, the Russians are about to fire, and that he wants to launch the missiles. And Denzel Washington is like a little more level-headed, and he's like, we have this other message. We don't know what the full message was. We have to confirm it before we can launch. Tension ensues.
Yep. And what's interesting, there is a wonderful metaphor buried in here about Limpazon or stallions. And it is really important to note that this is an argument that they have early on, and then it's an argument they conclude at the end. But every bit of information that both men give about the stallions is wrong.
Wrong.
Mm-hmm. They are both wrong.
And one says it's from Spain, one says it's from Portugal.
Yeah, and the color of birth is actually wrong too. When they're arguing about that, like, well, they're white, and yeah, they're born black. No, they're both wrong. It's really fascinating because, as we talked about, how they're both right, they both have the legality of the Navy on their side, but they are ultimately both wrong at the same time. And why? Because Gene Hackman is right about the necessity of the chain of command, especially in a wartime situation. And Denzel Washington is absolutely right that they need to double check this information, because if they don't, they could end up being the ones to start a war. And so they are both absolutely right, but they are both dead wrong in how they go about doing it. And this leads to mutiny after mutiny after mutiny.
Yeah, this is kind of the mutinies on the Bounty, because it keeps happening over and over again. And it is fascinating. I actually saw this movie for the first time in a social psychology class. And at first, as we're watching the submarine movie, I'm like, I don't really. And then I start to realize that this is a movie about what you do when two people are completely just in their opposing views in an important question, and they both have complete justification for why they wish to proceed. And like you said, they are both right and they're both wrong. This is a Kobayashi Maru situation.
Yeah, there is no, if only these two men were merged into one man and had all the right stuff going on.
And I love the fact that early on in this movie, they establish that Gene Hackman does not like Denzel Washington, but it's because he is not his regular executive officer. And two, he still respects him enough that he's like, I don't want you to kiss my ass and I don't want you to save yours. So early on in this movie, when they're butting heads, Denzel is not afraid to say the thing that ultimately he has to say, which is that I do not concur with you and I will not confirm the order to launch.
Well, and the big problem is that Gene Hackman is a military man, and he is an obstinate military man, and he considers himself someone who... What this is the argument of book smarts versus street smarts. You know, Gene Hackman knows he's not a incredibly well-studied man, but he is a guy who's been at sea a lot and he knows his shit. And he's, as they say in the movie, he's the last sub commander who has actually seen combat. Like, he's actually been in combat situations, not training. He was actually in combat. Also, keep in mind, this is the 90s. And old man Cargill, you know what? Here, old man Cargill. Two this episode.
Okay.
In the 90s, keep in mind that our military had aged out. Average people, usually in the military, most enlisted people leave after their 20 years. Some go to 25. But rarely do you have anyone in the military that's been in there for 30 years. And when you consider that we got out of Vietnam in the early 70s, and here we are in the early 90s, there's nobody that had seen war. Like, this is a group of young people in the military who had not experienced a wartime situation. So the very threat of this kind of war, you know, was nuts. Like, it was, so you did not have people who knew what it was like to be under fire. So saying that this guy was the last guy to see real action is kind of a big fucking deal, because it's like, oh shit, this guy's been around.
Yeah.
This guy knows what it's like to be shot at, like, and none of these other guys do. And so it is this guy who's like, that's who he is, and he knows it.
Right.
He knows that he's the only guy that knows what it's like and that has that experience. But then here comes this college educated, smart motherfucker, top of his class, smarter than everyone else in the room, who also knows it.
Right.
And these are two guys who natively aren't going to like each other. And interestingly enough, in the way that Tony Scott did. Tony Scott does not get enough credit for the fact that he made more movies with African-American leads than he did without them.
Yeah.
These are two stereotypes that would normally be flipped. Normally, the street smart experienced person would be the black person and the white person would be the college educated one. And Tony Scott said, fuck that, and has it flipped. And so here we have the smartest guy in the room, you know, the most educated guy in the room, be the African-American man. And it's the white guy that's the street smart, I've been around the block kind of guy. Yeah. And that's how subversive Tony Scott was. And this movie is entirely about those ideologies butting heads.
And I think it's important to note that even though this movie begins with images of President Clinton, even though the conflict centers around Chechnya, the temptation to call this dated needs to be avoided, because that very thing about it thematically makes this movie timeless, because it's about the changing of the guard. It's about the idea that there will always be the stalwart who's refusing to listen to the perspective of youth, whether that's in the military, whether that's in politics, business, you name it. This movie, because of that central conflict that you just laid out, is the reason that this movie remains timeless. And you could pick it up, like we talked on a Patreon episode about the Generation Z of movie consumers. They can pick up this movie, and if they key in on that, they're going to find this movie every bit as accessible as it would have been the day it came out.
Yeah, and except that at the same time, because it's so steeped in its time, and they turned into the skit on that and just said, fuck it, let's just get into what this is now, you buy it as a war movie set at the edge of war. Like, that just was happening, something that could have happened in the early 90s.
Yeah, and this movie lives and dies by the performances and by the conflict between Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. And when I revisited the movie, I've seen it several times for this recording, I literally had to stop everything that was going on in my apartment. That scene where they first are at each other's throats that ends with Denzel telling the chief of the boat to arrest the captain. I realized when that scene was over that I was like half standing up. It was just that tense and uncomfortable.
You repeat this order or I'll find somebody who will.
Hell no, you won't, sir.
You're relieved of your position. Cobb, remove Mr. Hunter from the control room. Get Lieutenant Zimmer in here right now.
No, sir. I do not concur and I do not recognize your authority to relieve me under command under Navy regulations.
Cobb, arrest this man and get him out of here.
Under operating procedures governing the release of nuclear weapons, we cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Cobb, what are you waiting for?
Sir. This is expressly why your command must be repeated. It requires my assent. I do not give it. And furthermore, you continue upon this course and insist upon this launch without confirming this message first. I will be
Chief of the boat.
Back by the rules of precedence.
Captain commanding officer. Command,
the USS Alabama.
Regulations, I order you to place the XO under arrest on the charge of
Navy regulations.
I say again, I order you to place the XO under arrest on the charge of mutiny.
Those two guys, and they actually mentioned in the IMDb trivia that Tony Scott used four cameras sometimes to shoot particular scenes just so that he captured it from every angle. And I guarantee you, that was one of the scenes, because those guys don't look like they break stride for a second in that entire moment.
No.
Jesus Christ.
Also, it should be pointed out that the Navy wasn't fucking happy with this movie.
Okay, this is one of the rare times that I will ever do this. Let's talk about the goofs section of the IMDb, because if you read the goofs section of the IMDb, it is clear that it was written by a naval man with an axe to grind with this movie. I'm not making this shit up. Listen, this is just some of it. Superior officers are not permitted to arbitrarily punish subordinates with physical exercises, basic training drill instructor would. When the captain conducts his first interview, the new executive officer, the chief of the boat, is present. This is highly irregular and unlikely to occur because the chief of the boat is an enlisted man. This is like a well actually in verbal form. This is like a person who is a well actually. Several characters, especially Ramsey, refer to the submarine as a ship. Traditionally, a submarine is referred to as a boat. And he literally goes on to talk about the captain's, the chief's cover lack the gold band. Like, uniform discrepancies.
Well, yeah, because the Navy read the script. Because whenever you make a military film, they actually, each department of the military has an office that literally those guys' job is to read scripts that involve the military and approve whether or not they'll give any support. They did not want to support this movie. They did not want to help with technical advising. They did not want to help with equipment or anything else. In fact, there's a shot in this movie of a submarine submerging that was literally Tony Scott in a helicopter with a camera following a submarine, waiting for it to submerge so he could get the fucking shot, because the military would not let them use a submarine. Like, this is, they were against this because they didn't like the idea of showing a breakdown in the chain of command on a nuclear submarine.
Which is interesting, considering something like this actually did happen on a nuclear submarine. I'm sorry, was that classified? I'm sorry, I probably should have said anything. Apparently, in 1962, on October 1st, a Russian sub B-59 was making a delivery to Cuba when it was spotted by a Navy destroyer that started dropping practice depth charges, like not enough to destroy it, but just to let the submarine know, well, we know you're here, trying to get it to surface so they could identify it. Well, this submarine had been out of contact with Russia for a very long time, and when the depth charges started falling, they weren't entirely sure whether war had broken out or not, and the commander of the submarine wanted to launch the was convinced that it had and wanted to launch the nukes. And apparently it came down, it had to be a consensus by, I believe it was four officers, and one of them refused to consent. So literally almost this exact plot happened in the 60s.
This happened, yeah, to Russia. It also happened to Russia another time when the radar said that we had launched nuclear missiles at them. They were tracking missiles. They ordered a launch, and the guy sitting at the command thing wouldn't do it. He just refused. He said, no, this is not right. This is not what you guys think it is. He refused to launch the missiles. And 15 minutes passed and all hell was raining down on this guy. And then it was discovered that that wasn't a missile, that it was just the way the sunlight was coming through the atmosphere because of the reflection of frozen water particles and such.
So Tommy Lee Jones is back in this movie and describing alien landings, like in him, yes. Men in Black.
And they were like, oh, holy shit, we almost launched nuclear war. In fact, that guy who said no just recently passed away.
Oh, wow.
And it was treated like a hero as a result. Because
actually, not all heroes wear capes. Thank you very much.
Sometimes they wear cloaks.
Sometimes they wear cloaks and mucklucks. Yeah, no, it's crazy to me that the Navy had such a hard time wrapping its head around the plot and literally refused to give any kind of cooperation to Tony Scott. He ended up relying on the French Navy for a lot of the shoot. And yet their principal problem was, we don't like the idea that you've come up with the situation where this can happen. And it's like, guys, this kind of thing could happen. Like, it has
happened.
They don't like
the military being seen in a bad light. They don't like them being seen as the bad guys or the antagonists, or that the chain of command doesn't work. Like, that's the type of stuff that they don't want. And especially at this point in time, because again, this is the early 90s and they were still recovering their reputation from Vietnam. This is pre 9/11. This is pre rah rah. We love our military. We love our troops. You know, this is pre, you know, this is not, yellow ribbons on our cars. Mm-hmm. This is still people bitter, about what happened in Vietnam and what soldiers did. And so the military was really super touchy at this point of how they were represented. So
I guess I can totally understand that. I do think, though, that it's important to kind of frame it in this context, because that story, the fact that this is a breakaway Russian dictator, it's a conflict with this kind of Russian faction, is really important because the conflict between Ramsey and Hunter, obviously, is supposed to be microcosmic for the Cold War. I mean, when you boil down the conflict of a nuclear conflict of nations to a battle of wills between two people, like, that's always really interesting to me when you're saying something about sort of geopolitical landscapes in conflict between two individuals. And again, this movie doesn't really, the villain of this movie is outlined by Denzel in a line where he says, in no uncertain terms, he says, in my humble opinion, in the nuclear world, the true enemy is war itself. That's what this movie is. This movie is about how war itself, nuclear war, is the only possible enemy, because as we've said time and time again, they're both righteous in their stance on why they should and should not launch these nukes.
Another interesting thing is the fact that you can boil this movie down into its ideologies versus conservative and liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But the way they portray it is equally fair to both ideologies, which is uncommon, especially in Hollywood films. Like,
yeah.
You just don't see the conservative viewpoint as shown in its truest, most, in its purest form.
Yeah.
You always see the ugly side of it. And vice versa. It's like in conservative films, you know, the way liberals are portrayed are always in the worst manner. And this is, both of these guys know their shit and are right according to their ideologies, but they're also wrong. And that is a very important point about ideologies, is the fact that there is no one person on the political spectrum that has all the answers and is right in the situations. Like, there is always something wrong. There is something you're doing that is harmful as well as helpful. And I think that's a very interesting point to take.
Well, and it's also important to note that in this movie, as we've talked about, multiple mutinies. You know, they overthrow Ramsay, and then Ramsay's faction, led by James Gandolfini, kind of release him and try to take the boat back. But at the end of the movie, when, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, when they finally decode that second message and realize that it was an abort, that, you know, we've taken care of this Raddick guy, it's over, every single sailor on this submarine starts cheering that they don't have to launch that missile. So even though they have been at each other's throats as to whether, like, and half of this boat wants that missile to be fired, when the threat is neutralized, all of that is gone, and they are just happy they didn't have to do it. War is the villain of this movie.
Yep.
And it's incredible to watch how Tony Scott creates, you know, because a lot of submarine movies, and ballsy as this movie is to call out the greats, Run Silent, Run Deep, Das Boot, I think it's every bit on the same level as those movies in terms of submarine films, because creating that tension and that claustrophobia is so important. And he does it so brilliantly in this film. And I love all of the different ways that he creates peril inside of this submarine that has nothing to do with the other submarine trying to sink it.
Yeah, this is one of the very best submarine movies ever made. And were Das Boot not in existence, I think it would be the best submarine movie ever made. I think Das Boot is the greatest anti-war film ever made. I love Das Boot. The theatrical cut, not the super long version. It is a phenomenal film, but this is the greatest popcorn submarine movie ever made, hands down. Like, I love Run Silent, Run Deep. Like, that's when and if we get around to doing some older films, Run Silent, Run Deep is on my short list of things that I want to cover. But this is the one that I watch over and over again, because it's just every element of this is perfect.
Would you say that Run Silent, Run Deep is a deep cut? Dive! Dive! The joke didn't work! Dive! 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 No, I'm...
Stargrove!
I am with you 100%, and I think you finally nailed what it is for me that makes this movie appropriate for junk food cinema, is that it is a popcorn submarine movie. Mm. That is not to say there is anything lacking in the quality department of this film, but it feels very, it's that Hans Zimmer score that's very, it's very summery. It just, it puts you in the mood for a blockbuster. It puts you in the mood for being in an air-conditioned theater in the dark and watching some kind of great spectacle, great action on the screen. At the same time, it delivers characters with really interesting conflicts with one another and building this tension and this geopolitical kind of message. And also, the thing I really find interesting about Crimson Tide is its use of real time. There are two particular instances in this movie where the time frame that is laid out by a character is the actual time that elapses in the movie. One of which is when our radio technician is told, you have 3 minutes to get this radio up and running. From the time he is told that to the time the EAM is received is 2 minutes and 38 seconds. Not only that, the last 60 minutes of the movie is 60 minutes to launch, 60 minutes to credits. It's pretty fucking cool. Like, so he's really ratcheting that up by literally saying, it takes this long, you are going to see every single minute that occurs between now and the end of this ticking clock, and you are going to be thrilled every second of the way.
God help you if you're wrong.
If I'm wrong, then we're at war. God help us all.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, and I am very, very happy with this one, guys. This week's junk food pairing.
Come on.
It's a submarine sandwich.
Of course.
It's a submarine sandwich. Some call it a hoagie. Some call it a grinder. Others cry out for a hero. But there is nothing subpar about a sub sandwich. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, is that the use of the term submarine or sub after the resemblance of the roll to the shape of a submarine is widespread, and its origins are a little cloudy. However, one theory says the submarine was brought to the U.S. by Dominic Conti, an Italian immigrant who came to New York in the early 1900s. He is said to have named it after seeing the recovered 1901 submarine called Finn and Ram in the Patterson Museum of New Jersey in 1928. So the submarine sandwich is supposedly called a submarine sandwich because the creator of the submarine sandwich was in fact a big fan or had just seen the wreckage of a submarine. So it's coming full sub-circle. So I highly recommend chowing to get some meat, get some veggies, split that roll open, and have yourself a great night of popcorn submarines and delicious submarine sandwiches. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury. You can also find this show at Junk Food Cinema. You can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as Blog Talk Radio. Please rate and review us on iTunes if you would be so kind. Also, if you really love this show, if it's the kind of thing that would make you go down faster than this submarine, go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you actually get access to content that nobody else gets to hear. You also get ad-free early versions of the show, and we want to make a special note to let you guys know that February was a shorter month, and it kind of got away from us, so we are definitely going to deliver that February deep dish for our $5 level patrons and above. This is the second week, so it may have already posted, but just to let you know, we haven't forgotten. 28 days, man. 28 days later, we forgot the month was over. So we will get right on that. next week, as continuing the Denzel Watchingthon, we are taking a trip into the virtual world that makes hackers look downright prescient. It's Virtuosity on the Denzel Watchingthon. How excited are you?
I am very excited.
Snack the planet, guys. Now, in closing, I just want to remind you that in my humble opinion, in the fast food world, the true enemy is the all-day breakfast itself.